Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Hello and welcome to another special Between Takes episode of Missing Frames. I'm your host, Sean Eastridge. We're hanging out on the Nerd Party Network over at thenerdparty.com. Make sure to check us out and follow us on Twitter at Join Nerd Party, like the Facebook page, The Nerd Party, and follow us on Instagram at The Nerd Party. In case you're not already aware, normally on Missing Frames, we watch all the movies we should have seen by this point in our lives, but every so often we like to take a break from that to do things like movie marathons, filmmaker interviews, all kinds of fun stuff. So in today's Between Takes episode, we're chatting with Robert Whitey, an incredible filmmaker who's done everything from acclaimed documentaries about the Marx Brothers to directing Larry David and Curb Your Enthusiasm. You know, no big deal. His latest documentary is entitled Kurt Vonnegut, Unstuck in Time. Whitey co-directed it with Don Argott, and it not only details the life of the author, but of Robert's wonderful friendship with him. He first approached Vonnegut about the documentary back in 1982, and now after all these years, what is that? I can't do math. 30 years? How old am I? Oh my God, that's such a long time. But after all this time, it's finally being released, which is so exciting. Kurt Vonnegut, I mean, he's one of my favorite writers. I've been a fan of his for years since I first read Slaughterhouse-Five back in 2011, and I've been anxiously awaiting this film ever since I donated to its Kickstarter back in 2015. I'm also a big Robert Whitey fan, so it was really an honor to chat with him about this amazing movie and the incredible person who inspired it. If you want to learn more about the film, make sure you go check out the website, vonnegutmovie.com. It's going to be in theaters this Friday, November 19th. It's also going to be on demand, so please, please check it out. It's a really, really beautiful film. You can also, if you want to, follow the film on Facebook and other social media platforms. You can go to Twitter. I think it's at VonnegutDoc, D-O-C. And you can also just search for Unstuck in Time on Facebook, and you will find the official Facebook page. You can stay up to date with all the news and updates about the film's release. I guess that's it. Let's get to it. I hope you enjoy listening.
Now available to own on video cassette.
I want you to know this is the only Kickstarter I've ever contributed to in my entire life. Does that make me a bad or great person?
No, it may, well, it depends. How much did you give? for five bucks, I'm cutting this off now.
Let's put it this way.
What was your reward?
My reward? I got the postcards.
Oh, okay. That was something.
Yeah. See, so we can be friends.
Your Kickstarter dollars at work.
Relatively generous. I was fresh out of college. I was in my mid to late 20s. Is that
the idea that you're talking about the Kickstarter campaign as though that was something way back in your past, which it was, is frightening because, you know, I first wrote to Vonnegut in 82, getting authorization to do this. We started filming in 88. He died in 2007. I was still fiddling around with the film. Then I brought in Don Argott to co-direct with me. We did the Kickstarter campaign in 2015. It was like, okay, now we can get this thing finished. That was 6.5 years ago.
I was going to say, for me, I'm like, I've been waiting with bated breath to see this, and that's nothing compared to what you've been going through.
Sure. Now, let me ask you, as a Kickstarter contributor, was there ever a point where you thought, oh, this isn't going to happen? Who are we kidding?
From the get-go. I was like, who's this Robert Whitey guy? Who does he think he is?
You went in assuming that.
I saw Kurt Vonnegut. I didn't ask questions. I donated money and I didn't even think like, oh, wait a second. Is this ever going to happen? No, you guys did a great job keeping everybody up to date. And there was always this sense, I'll speak personally and I'll go ahead and speak on behalf of the entire Kickstarter community, even those who didn't donate, that it felt very... There was this sense of love and affection. I don't know if you guys felt that, but you did a great job of keeping us up to date every step of the way. And even though it took 6 years for us, it took 30 or so years for you. If you want to feel really old, because we're already talking about making people feel old, I was born in 86. So you started filming this for about as long as I've been alive.
4 years before you were born. Well, yeah. I approached him in 82. It was 6 years before I had any kind of seed money to get started.
So you wrote a letter to him and you said, I want to make a film about you. And it was a letter correspondence, or did you actually go to visit him before you even started filming?
No. It was a good old fashioned typed up letter in an envelope with a stamp on it. And I sent it to him in 82. And my first film, I was 22 when I did my first film, which was my documentary on the Marx Brothers. And that had aired on PBS. And then I wrote him a couple of months later. And I said, you know, Mr. Vonnegut, you don't know me, but I did this film on the Marx Brothers because I'm a big fan of theirs and I'm a big fan of yours. I'd like to do a film about you. And what happened was he happened to catch the Marx Brothers film on TV because he, like I, am a big fan of old comedies. In fact, that was one of our earliest bonding topics, was talking about the Marx Brothers or Laurel and Hardy and W.C. Fields. So when I wrote to him, I wasn't just some 22-year-old or 23-year-old guy who, I'd like to make a film about you. He viewed me as a professional who had made a film that he had liked. So that's why he wrote me back. And he said, I'm an author. My work is on the page. It's not on film. I don't know how you make a film about an author, but you're welcome to try. And here's my phone number. Call me. And next time you're in New York, we'll get together. Now, I was such a Vonnegut fan that imagine getting a letter from him saying, here's my phone number, call me. It'd be like, you know, somebody who worshiped Kerouac or Salinger.
I mean, as a Vonnegut fan, yes, I completely understand. Yeah.
And then, well, you're feeling that thrill now talking to me, I'm sure.
Just here, I mean, but, absolutely, just by association, for sure. Yeah, I donated to the Robert Whitey Kickstarter, not the Vonnegut. What are you talking
that's
about?
That's right. Well, that'll be next. But, so next time I was in New York, which was later that year, I came to visit him. And so it was 6 years before I was able to raise any money to start filming. So that started in 88 and just continued on and off until a few years before he died in 2007. It was after his death that I felt really, I mean, the film was always at risk of not being completed during all that time because I never had the financing. Right? It was always out of my own pocket.
That's what I was going to ask you, because obviously it went on for so long. And my understanding is you kind of did it sort of in your free time when you had time or when you had money.
It was a hobby project. Yeah. You know, if I had the time, I didn't have the money, because if I had the time, it meant I wasn't working. And if I had the money, it meant I was working. So I didn't have the time, but there were these pockets in between where I'd saved up some money and had a little hiatus, like, you know, between seasons on Curb Your Enthusiasm. So I'd do a little more filming with him, but you know, after he died, I was really kind of lost about how to go forward. And then it was a couple of mutual friends of Kurt's and mine who knew him, knew me, and said, you know, the story about you becoming such close friends with your literary idol, the subject of your film, and the evolution of that friendship and how it affected the film and your struggle to make the film over the years, that story should be told as part of the film. You should wrap that up within the documentary, which I really hesitated to do because I didn't want to be on camera. I didn't want this to seem like an ego trip, like, oh, Kurt Vonnegut and I were such good friends. I hate that kind of thing. But it did seem to be the only way out, you know. And I'm a big believer in full disclosure. So the fact that the subject of my film had become such a good friend of mine, I mean, how do I leave that out? So the trick was figuring out how to do that. And then once the decision was made, and that's when I brought in Don Argott, a wonderful documentary filmmaker, because if I was going to be in the film, I didn't want to be filming interviews with myself or telling my own story. It's too aggrandizing. So I figure, all right, I'll bring someone else in and I'll focus on the Vonnegut biography while he sort of tells the meta story.
That helped give perspective, it sounds like, for you.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it just helped me figure out how to tell this story, how to structure it. Right. And so at the end of the day, the film is kind of a hybrid between our two strengths, because I've always done these biographical documentaries and he's done more verite types of films. And so it's a combination of the two, and it worked out. So I can look at this film and enjoy it and not cringe every time I'm on screen, just because the structure of it seems to work.
I was going to ask you that, because after so many years, and I'm sure there was a sense of excitement when you met your goal for Kickstarter.
We ran it for a month. We got cut short a couple days because I told my guys I'd put it up for a month, forgetting that it was February. So we lost like two or three days right there. I think our goal was 250,000. The first day we hit 50,000, thought, oh, this is going to be a breeze. And then the second day was like 3,000. It's like, oh, I get it. This is going to be a roller coaster, which it was. It was a nail biter. We hit 250 a few days before the end of the campaign and then got another 50. We made it to 300,000. Which, by the way, was enough to get the project moving again, but still not enough to really finish it. I mean, it's expensive to do these things, but it allowed us to arrive at a cut And then the short version of the story is that IFC Films, the good people at IFC Films, saw the cut and said, yeah, we want this. And then they gave me an advance, awesome. Which helped me finish all pro, you know, post-production and everything.
But you must have felt some sense of, like, after all these years and amassing so much footage and continually working on it, and you guys do such a great job of interweaving the stories, because like you said, the challenge is you feeling like, I don't want this to become an ego trip or something where I'm trying to shove myself into the limelight. And it doesn't feel like that at all. It feels very organic, and it's a beautiful story, very well told with great perspective. But I imagine the sense of pressure. There is a sense of celebration. We did it. We're making the movie. It's finally happening. But did you have this moment of like, oh God, now it's going to happen. I'm going to have to actually leave this project behind after so many years?
No, go ahead. I'm happy to leave it behind. Make no mistake about it. I'm happy to leave it behind. But what was interesting was that the Kickstarter thing was obviously good news, because now we had some production funds to move forward. The scary part was now I had people to answer to, whereas before I never did, because it was all out of my own pocket. Mm. So, you know, now that, you know, even if somebody gave $5, I felt, you know, we owe them a film. So now the pressure was on. And then the years started to add up after the Kickstarter campaign. And I thought, oh God, you know, the natives are going to get restless. I have to say the Kickstarter contributors have been very lovely, very supportive. There have been a couple nasty ones about, hey, what did you do? Take our money? And
I think what you mean to say, they've been very lovely and supportive, especially this one Kickstarter backer, Sean Eastridge, who was so generous and got postcards and was probably the greatest Kickstarter backer of any project.
No. No, oh. he was a pain. But have some compromising photos of me, so I do have to do his podcast if he ever asks me. So it's been weird, but you know, look, here's how I put it in perspective, and this is not an exclusive for you. Unfortunately, I've said this to a couple of people, but this will make it clear. When I first met with him in his home in New York, I was 23 years old, and he was just coming up on his 60th birthday. And I would refer to him as the old man, you know, affectionately, like, hey, I'm going to have lunch with the old man when I go to New York. The film is now finished and I'm 62. I'm 2 years older than the old man was when this little brash kid sat down with him and said, I want to do this movie. So it's been 2/3 of my life. And I've said, you know, I don't know what my life is going to feel like when this film is behind me, but I'm really anxious to find out. Mm. And, but there will be some sense of withdrawal. I'm already finding now that if I come across something of his that I didn't know about, or something on YouTube or something that he wrote,
filing it away. You're like, I got to, yes. Oh, wait a second. I can't.
Yes. I'm thinking, how can I work this? I wonder what, and then it's like, Bob, the film is finished. Knock it off.
So I mean, you could take a Peter Jackson, George Lucas approach, and it'll never be over. You just make continuous cuts of it.
Yeah. So I'm going through that decompression phase right now, but ultimately it's a relief when I realize I don't have to figure out how to work this into the film. It's done. There's one thing I came across that I really kicked myself that I didn't find it earlier. That would have been something nice to include, but everything else is, no, I look at the film now and I'm satisfied and it feels finished. But it's, you know, earlier you used the word organic, which I was pleased to hear, because you're the second person today who's used that. And I'm doing all these interviews in reference to the inclusion of my story in the film. Yeah. And it's the word that I used, that I aspired to when I'd have conversations with Don, is I'd say this has to feel organic. And, you know, we tried variations of using me, and basically the debate went like this. I kept saying less of me. And Don kept saying, no, more of you, more of you. We were trying to get that balance right, because, you know, at first there's a little bit of me and then I disappear for a half hour and then I reappear, and people will say, well, you know, the concept is nice, but you disappeared and we forgot about it. And then it's kind of shocking when you reappear. So we try to get that balance, and the phrase that I was using at the time was, I said, you know, it seems to work as a structural device, but we haven't stuck the landing yet. Mm-hmm. And we just kept working on it. And then finally I felt, okay, that's it. And people have said, you really stuck the landing. So it's gratifying, but you know, it's been a long road.
Yeah. Well, that's what it felt like. It felt very much like every time I was thinking in the back of my mind, like, this is amazing. This is amazing. Where's Bob? And that's also a crazy thing to think, you know, as a Kurt Vonnegut fan, watching a Kurt Vonnegut documentary, to be thinking about your story and to think about like, oh, I want to see more about him. That's an incredible accomplishment in general. Like, I know it's weird to kind of think of it that way, but I felt your openness and your willingness to be vulnerable and to allow yourself to be a part of this really, really enriches the film in an incredible way.
Well, thank you. I think it's a way in for people because, and you know, Vonnegut was not a conventional writer, so to speak. Mm. So he deserves something other than a conventional sort of PBS style documentary. So also, you know, the people who were talking me into this being in the film were people who knew Vonnegut's work. And they said, you know, that's how Vonnegut would have approached it. And I realized that's right. You know, if he got stuck in how to advance the story, he would put himself into the book and interact with his characters the way he did with Kilgore Trout in Breakfast of Champions. Does that a little bit in Slaughterhouse-Five. And then Timequake, which is really the great metaphor for our film, was a book that he was stuck on for 10 years and couldn't figure out how to do it. And then he wound up, you know, creating this sort of interstitial material between the chapters, explaining the struggle and finishing the book and whatever he did that day, he went out to buy stamps or whatever. So the book, ultimately, you know, like I'll say half of it roughly is the story that he intended to tell. And the other half is him telling you about the difficulties he's having in writing the book. So that's
now, I thought you were going to say the big breakthrough of Timequake was when he realized I've got to put Bob in this. And then that's what opened up the floodgates when you finally, your cameo there, appearance there that rocked the world.
When I first started reading Vonnegut in high school, I think in the foreword to Wampeter's Foam and Grand Falloons, he mentions a young guy who had written him a fan letter. And I think he mentions it by name. And I thought, wow, that guy, how cool for him to be in a Vonnegut book. What a dream. And then his final novel, Timequake, in 97. You know, once we met, he would send me early pressings of his books, you know, sometimes, you know, uncorrected galleys or whatever. Sometimes they were bound. The books were basically finished by then, but it must've been like 2 a.m. I was reading Timequake before it was published. And these were just like Xerox pages, loose pages that I'd read one, put it aside, read the next one, put it aside. And, you know, towards the end of the book, he's rewriting about this clam bake in honor of Kilgore Trout. And he's telling you, I think in Newport, Rhode Island, and he's telling you about all the people at the clam bake. Well, and they're basically all of his friends. He's sort of paying tribute to his friends, knowing it's his final book. And there was my name. And I quite freaked out. You know, I was attending the clam bake. And he says, you know, Robert Whitey wasn't there to see me. He wanted to, a long last, meet Kilgore Trout. So I was in the book and it was quite crazy. I talk about it in the film and the facts I sent him the next day, we see the facts.
Yeah, and Kurt's work is so extensive. His bibliography is so, like, I mean, he's written so much and over so many years, but how tough was it to, you do it really well, but there's a sense that obviously Slaughterhouse-Five is kind of the central piece of his career, because it was, that was the big breakthrough for him.
Sure.
Was there any other book that you were like, I know Breakfast of Champions is a big one for you. That was your first, is that still your favorite, would you say? Is that your favorite?
I don't know if it's my favorite. It holds a special place in my heart, like a first love, because it was the book that introduced me to his work. And it's a very funny book and a perfect book for a high school, sort of iconoclastic or rebellious high school student to read.
Yeah. Was there any other book that you would have like been like, let's give a little bit more time to this one as well?
Well, not necessarily, but in general, you know, the film is not a deep dive into his works, although, again, there's a handful of books that we spend some time with, certainly Slaughterhouse-Five, a little bit with God Bless You, Mr. Rosewater, with the introduction of Kilgore Trout, Timequake, his final book, which was not a novel, but a collection of essays, A Man Without a Country. But when I would have early screenings of the film for friends of mine, I would ask them afterwards, do you feel cheated that there wasn't more about the books? Did you want to hear more about the books? And to a person, they all said no, because they thought there was enough story between Vonnegut's biography, which is very interesting, and again, this meta element. They were entertained and felt that they didn't need to learn more about the books themselves. They're almost all referenced at some point, but we don't, you know, Cat's Cradle, to answer your question directly, Cat's Cradle, I would have liked to have dug into a little bit more, and we did. And there's, it wound up on the cutting room floor, sadly. But, you know, I went through all of the original typed, you know, hand-typed manuscripts of all of his books and his short stories at the Lilly Library at the Indiana University in Bloomington, where they have all of his papers. And he had written an early short story called Ice Nine. Now you as a Vonnegut film would know the connection of Ice Nine to Cat's Cradle.
Yeah.
And so he wrote it as a short story and tried to sell it, and he couldn't sell it. Finally, somebody wanted to buy it for like $300, and finally said, you know what, I'm gonna work on this a bit more. And that became Cat's Cradle. And if he had sold that story to that, it was a science fiction magazine, Cat's Cradle probably never would have been written. And there was, you know, stuff in the film about how the whole concept of Ice Nine really came out of conversations with his brother, who was a research scientist at General Electric. And so, you know, that's the problem. Unless you're doing a, you know, Netflix miniseries, stuff winds up on the cutting room floor. But I'm happy ultimately with the final choices.
You and me both. I don't think it hurts the film at all. It's really lovely. And there's one story in particular I really enjoyed, and the way you kind of tell the story of your friendship with Kurt and how you kind of really, in a way, became part of the family. And the story that I that really kind of felt that way with was Nanette talking about how you were kind of invited and she was afraid, like she thought she was going to get quality time with her dad, and then she's like, what's this filmmaker doing? Her and I wanted to talk a little bit about your relationship with the family, and just I love that that the her kind of being saying like, oh, I was really angry and upset that I thought I was going to get this time and then you were going to be there, and then it wasn't so bad.
Yeah, she says, but it all worked out.
Yeah.
And the reason she said that is she and I, to this day, are very close friends. I mean, we are really like brother and sister. She's the closest thing I've had to a surrogate sister in my life. And we're very tight. And I'm very close with his daughter, Edie, as well. Although Nanny and I are especially close. The son, Mark, you know, we get along, we're friendly, but we don't, you know, we don't stay in touch. We don't call each other to chat. And even the nephews, one of his nephews, Steve Adams, I've actually known for years. So I feel very tied into the family, and they do feel like an extended family of mine to a certain degree. Nanny and Edie will both be at the premiere, which is part of Doc NYC on November 11th, which happens to be Kurt's 99th birthday, the eve of his centennial. So I'm so thrilled to have them there. And
have they seen the film yet?
They have, yeah. Everybody in the family has signed off with their approval.
That's great.
And I'm hearing from grandkids too, who didn't know him that well,
wow,
or remember him from their childhood, who were so thrilled to have this sort of chronicle of his life and see photos of their own parents when they were kids and all that. So it's quite triumphant that way. But yes, we talk about in the film for a wedding present, and Vonnegut was greatly encouraged me to marry my then girlfriend, who's now my wife of 24 years. For our wedding present, he gave us a pair of Victorian candlesticks. He said, identical to the ones his father gave him. And he in turn has given them to all of his kids on special occasions, like weddings and that sort of thing. So he says that it's basically, we're now officially a part of the family. He said, if there's ever a family gathering at Thanksgiving, you'll come and you'll bring your candlesticks.
Yeah, just unpack that. Like, I can't even imagine what that's like. Like, just, again, talking about your friendship with him, but your love for him and his work. And just like, you're a part of that. Like, you are a part of that family.
That's
an incredible thing.
It's a great privilege. And certainly it started out with that kind of pinch me, is this really happening feeling. I mean, he and I, we met up in Indianapolis. This was the same trip that Nanny came to. And yeah, she thought it was going to be just her and her dad. And then at the last minute, once she had arrived in Indianapolis, she said, oh, by the way, there's a film crew. And she said, what? Are you kidding? I thought it was you and me. And then, you know, out of that, she and I became lifetime friends. But I had flown into Indiana. He had driven. And we drove back together in his car from Indiana back to Manhattan. We drove in shifts. We'd nap and drive and did it in one shot. And we laughed so much on that trip. We were just laughing, listening to the radio, listening to things on NPR and commenting on them, just laughing and telling bad jokes and being bawdy, you know, as boys will be. And that was certainly a moment where I thought, how did this happen? Because I grew up just idolizing this guy in high school and college. Now I'm in a car. It was like on the road with Kurt Vonnegut. And we're just two guys laughing and being dopey, driving not halfway across the country, but maybe a third or a quarter. It was quite unbelievable.
Are there any other things that stand out to you that maybe didn't make it into the film, like something that you'll always cherish about your time with Kurt?
Well, there's all kinds of anecdotes. The one thing that was just a funny anecdote is, you know, certainly every time I was in New York, we'd spend time together, and he didn't come out to LA that frequently, but he did on occasion. We'd always get together. He'd have dinner here at the house. My wife was a good cook. But he came out to publicize a Showtime had done a bunch of his short stories as a little limited series. And so he was doing this promotional, you know, like a press conference. And I was there in the room with him. So somebody said to him, they said, how do you feel about, you know, films being made from your books? And specifically, how do you feel about Catch-22? Well, of course, Catch-22 was written by Joseph Heller. He's a good friend of Kurt's, not his. But people mistake him as the writer of Catch-22 all the time. And so he answered the question, you know, very straightforward. He said, well, you know, the books remain on the shelves for anyone to read, and good, bad, or indifferent, a movie doesn't change the book. So people are always welcome to look at the book. So he says, I don't feel that invested in what people do with the films. Let them do what they want. And then he pauses and he says, oh, and by the way, Catch-22 was written by Ray Bradbury. Which really made me laugh. I think I was the only one in the room laughing who was in on the joke, because, you know, most people know these names and they know the titles, but they haven't actually read them. So. But
I just want to say, I know I read you a message prior to this, but as a Kurt Vonnegut fan, as a fan of your work, I think this is a really, really beautiful gift. And I thank you, and I thank your entire team for making it. And I think it was well worth the 6-year wait for me, hopefully for you, worth the years and years, the decades that it took to make it. But
thanks. I just want to put in the thank you. And I did, your email really touched me. It was a really terrific validation.
Oh, that's great. Well, Bob, this has been such an honor. Honestly, if this isn't nice, what is?
There you go. Well, Kurt's up in heaven now, isn't he?
That's right.
That's his favorite joke.